Dr. M.T. Sinyika is a New Orleanian community leader and former professor at Dillard University and TSU. Founder of the Black Unitarian Universalist Caucus and Black Affairs Council, he is also former project manager for the African American Leadership Project. Ed Blakely is a former Washington insider, an internationally recognized leader in urban development and planning, advisor and author. For more in this series, search for Pacific Conversations wherever you find good podcasts and check out the website edtalks.com.au.
M.T. Sinyika. It's been what? 5, 7, 8? No, I left New Orleans in 2019, so that's 11 years. 12 years.
No, you know, you didn't leave in 2019, did you? That's just a couple of years.
I mean, 2009.
Ago. Ah, 2009. Ah, yes. That's 12 years ago.
12 years ago.
And they just had a mini Katrina this time, Ida.
Ida, yes. Mm-hmm. And the work we did when we were there saved the city. So thank you for all your input in that and helping us get Gentilly and all those places back up.
Well, we want to thank you also for being available to us at a time when we critically needed the expertise that you brought to the table. So we appreciate that very much.
So now we have another danger, not a hurricane, but we have a human rights danger. And that human rights danger in Texas, the great state of Texas, is about voting suppression, about minority rights, privileges. Like, what in the world, MT, is going on in Texas and why?
Well, thanks for asking that question, and that conversation is one that I think it's worth people who are not here in the United States understanding the dynamic of what we're witnessing here. First, let me just say that in the large context of the United States itself, there is a demographic shift that is occurring in the United States with projections that suggest that in the not too distant future, the United States will be a predominantly minority-majority country. That is to say that African-descended people, Hispanic, Latino, Latinx, descended people, Asians, Native Americans, people of color will be the predominant population. And those persons of European descent who have historically been the predominant majority in the country will no longer be that majority anymore. And that is sparking an enormous sense of dis-ease and discomfort for that majority population. Why? Because its own internal perception is that its day in history is up. Its time has passed its ability to internally manage itself, and its ability to have the hegemony and control, if you would, that it has exercised over the entirety of this country's history since its founding as a white racist country to this day, which many believe it still is the case. But the internal perception that is both spoken and unspoken would suggest that there is an emerging understanding on the part of the slowly shifting majority population that things are changing and that a new order is emerging in the society. And it is that new order that is causing deep reactions at many, many different levels, not just in the voting arena, but we're seeing this in education and the arguments over critical race theory, for instance. We're seeing it in some aspects of the cultural and creative production apparatus in the country. We see it in many of the media sources, and even inside of social media, all these rather far right wing media sources that are now emerging inside of the internet that are causing all these disturbances and the ways that people are using the internet, you know, in this country, it's almost at a point that you could begin to argue that the American empire has reached its terminus. Mm. And it may have reached the point where it is no longer the exceptional country that it used to be, and that its old white majority and hegemony of white males that had previously ruled and dominated the entirety of the country has taken the country about as far as the country can go. And so it reluctantly understands that there will be this demographic shift, but it's trying to hold on to whatever power it can hold on to, whatever the change in the demography happens to be. So that's, I think, a framework for what is happening in the entirety of the United States. And it's not just occurring in one place, but it is especially happening with a level of vehemence and intensity and deep passion wherever you have significant numbers of Black and brown, especially Black and brown people who make up the population of a state and who it appears as though will in a relatively short period take control of the politics of the state. Now, that doesn't translate as control of the economics yet. Yeah, but it certainly does the politics and the culture, which become a part of the dominant face of that particular state. So you see this in California already. You know California very well. You see this, I think, in New York. You're seeing this in a lot of Arizona. You certainly see it in Florida, and of course you're seeing it here in Tejas, in Texas. Texas is a state that has traditionally been ruby red, and it has been very heavily Anglo for a very long period of time. But Texas is now what California used to be in this country.
We were in California, Republicans were in the Senate. There's a guy named Nixon.
Yes. You remember that name.
Named Reagan. They were Republicans and elected by the majority.
Yes. And that was the majority of California at that time. And today, Texas has become the place. If you're looking for employment, Texas is a net job creating state. Mm-hmm. It has an exceptionally well-developed private sector here that is not lacking in capital and technical resources at all. So the state is constantly growing. You see it any city that you go to, whether it's Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, El Paso, you know, any one of the large cities you go to in Texas, you will see just expansion. There's no end to growth that happens in Texas. And in many places, you don't have zoning, but you have significant large numbers of populations moving into Texas to occupy this new job market that is here with this technological systems that are here. And it, of course, you know, this is the oil energy capital, you know, some say of the world, of the globe, but there's no shortage of capital here.
But you're also the missile producing capital of the world. The flight center for the missiles is in Houston, is it not?
Yeah, we have the Johnson Space Center is here in NASA. Yes, yes, yes. It is very much here, and it collaborates with five largest
internet firms. Computer firms are in Austin and Dallas.
That's right. Texas Instruments came out of that region years ago, years and years and years and years ago. And so we have here this combination of technology, of capital, of technology. The educational apparatus is very well developed and very sophisticated here. It is constantly growing. There's no shortage of land here, and people are moving here to take advantage of the new opportunities that are here. That's part of what I meant by Texas has become the new California. California used to be where people were moving, but the real estate costs, as you very well know, are so high in California. In Texas, the real estate costs are just dirt cheap. I mean, you can buy a mansion here, $300,000-$400,000, just about, that you could never buy in California. California, it would cost you $1 million. And so this availability of modestly priced real estate has become very attractive, especially to startup families, families that are in the middle somewhere in their career development. And that combination is attracting large numbers of persons, but they're mostly people whose politics are not red. They're rather purple, many of them blue. So it's purple to blue.
Well, so you're telling me that educated people are a menace to the Republican Party.
That's exactly who's more.
So they can be white as well as brown.
That's the other problem they have. That's the other problem they're having in Texas, is that the whites who are moving into Texas are purple or they're blue, they're not red. The red populations occupy the smaller parts of Texas, the little small counties and small cities and towns, which are just ubiquitous all over this state. But the large centers of intellectual life, of civic life, of technical life, of capital life, are the cities that keep Texas growing. And so the people who are moving here are attracted to its cities. And you can build a new city in Texas in a minute. You don't have regulatory problems, and there's no shortage of land. And so there are all these subdivisions constantly being built, and all these transportation arteries all over the place. It's something to just
tell me about that. Your cities. Are they heavily segregated?
They're both dynamics exist. One dynamic is that they are the traditional places that African Americans migrated to during the oil boom of the early 20th century. For instance, my family moved from New Orleans and Louisiana and came into the Houston area. And so they're located the same way as though they were migrating north into so-called ghettos. But here they were not always limited in the same way that you find it to be the case in the north, because cities were constantly expanding. They were not limiting themselves to traditional boundaries. They were constantly expanding. And so what began to happen is that suburbanization didn't take very long to begin to set in here. And while suburbanization was setting in, if you had the money, you could move into an emerging development. And so when you go to these new suburban areas, you see lots of black and brown faces, but you also have traditional neighborhoods that people first came to at the beginning of the 20th century, if not earlier than that. But so there has not been the same covenant restrictions, for instance, deed restrictions that you find in other places. Now, are there places that are still predominantly white? Yes, but the suburban area of these metropoles, if you would, are very comfortable and convenient with people of color, to use the broader term, with people of color among their midst. You don't have the same
problem. Money's the thing. If you got the money, you can be there.
If you got the money and the capacity to function in the culture, yeah. If you can tolerate what Texas is, if you can manage the transportation system, if you can adjust to this psychology of everything is big in Texas, and they must always win in whatever they do. I mean, if you can put up with some of the vagaries of Texas, it's an all right place to be if you're at that particular point. And if you're in the early stages of your profession, there are just enormous opportunities here.
All right. So now I have a sense of the demographics and the like. Which, by the way, is happening in a lot of places around the world, upsetting people. As you know, Europe's traditional population falling like a rock. Places mm-hmm. like Italy, the birth rate is negative in the white population. Germany's the same. Russia's the same. England is the same. And the immigrant population, you get a Brexit. Mm-hmm. You get places like Hungary where if you're wrong color, you can't enter. So this is, I think there's a global problem here that's been localized in the extreme in Texas. How is it then with this new population that you have a Republican vote in almost every election that wins. Trump won by what, 20% or so in Texas?
Yeah, in the presidential. But the last gubernatorial election was within a couple of, the senatorial election was the Ted Cruz election with Beto O'Rourke. It was just a couple of points. You know, to that, that's a reflection of this new demography. And of course, Beto is, I think he's about to run for governor this time. And we expect this to be a real tight race. I think Trumpism indeed did prevail, but the purple and blue areas of the state did exceptionally well in terms of local elections. We were very, very proud of the local power that that grew and was retained, which was another indicator to us that it wouldn't be too long before the state of Texas turns. And I don't think it's going to be 20 years before the politics shifts in the other direction. Because remember, this state was once a Democratic state during the Lyndon Johnson era of civil rights. And of course, once the civil rights legislation passed, Texas went red the way the rest of the South did. But I think
remind my listeners that Lyndon Johnson was from the South, but led the civil rights movement in the Congress when he was the president, and got the first Voting Rights Act in, the desegregation in 1964, led by Lyndon Johnson, a man from the South.
Yes, absolutely. And it's important to know that he was a consummate politician. He understood power extremely well, and he knew how to use it. And nobody was willing to cross him when he made his political
decisions. But he was prescient. He saw what is here coming.
I think he had the good sense to see it and left a legacy. Again, the peculiarity about living in Texas is that when you're living in a place like Austin, for instance, which is the state capital, Austin is very much like Berkeley. It is a very progressive city with progressive people, doesn't have the same intense racial animosities that you may find in other large-scale cities. I mean, they still have some problems, but it's not the kind of intense deep racial polarization, for instance, that you might find in a Chicago or parts of New York or, you know, those cities. It's a lot softer and smoother, if I could use that analog here. It's one that almost says, we about something different, and we're going to let you live if you let us live and do what it is that we also want to do. That's the attitude that I feel when I go to Austin, and just in terms of the way it makes me feel. And when I'm in Houston, I feel extremely comfortable here. I don't feel a sense of racial animosity.
Well, Dallas is the same, isn't it?
Dallas is very much similar to this. Sure it is. San Antonio, very much like that. El Paso is like that. So it's like two different universes in the state of Texas. Now, there are some parts of Texas when you start going to those little small towns. And I'm careful about how long I want to be there. Mm-hmm. Because that's really ruby red. And that's where Trumpism, you know, is very strong and very, very intensely present and felt. And this, which is not to say that we don't have, you know, Trumpism in other parts of Texas, but it's modulated and it's contained in such a way that the blue and purple populations are very clear about what they are going to tolerate and not tolerate. But at the level of the politics
situation, here from Australia, I saw members of your legislature go to Washington preventing a vote on what seemed to be the most outrageous laws in the world regarding voting. Only having one voting booth that you drive through in an entire county, whole bunch of things about signatures and this and that. Why would even white people put up with this?
Fear.
But they, if you can't vote except for one place, they got to get there too.
Well, you have to remember the way the districts in the state are gerrymandered right now. They are gerrymandered to always ensure Republican domination and control of the presence in Washington, D.C., both at the level of the House of Representatives and certainly at the level of the Senate. And that's intentional. Now, of course, we're in that battle right now. And part of what the For the People Act does is to prevent that kind of partisan gerrymandering in the future. That's part of why, of course, the other side doesn't want it, because it's going to prevent that kind of partisan gerrymandering. But everybody knows that that is the pattern in the U.S. right now, is that the Republicans maintain control even when they're not the majority, because they've gerrymandered all the districts. And in Texas, that's exactly what happened, because right now there's a fear that we may not even have an African-American or Latino, predominantly African-American or Latino district at all with this first set of maps that have come out. Now, part of what is going on is the pushback, if you would. It's the racist pushback, just like the critical race theory debate that is happening within certain cities, especially as it relates to their school districts and what they think should and should not be taught. It's a right-wing reaction that is saying, look, enough is enough. We have seen what it is that these people of color are doing and have done, and we've got to stop them somewhere. And they tried it through Trumpism, overt Trumpism, which partially succeeded in some ways. But at the deeper level of society, they realize that it is impossible for this wave to be stopped unless you just completely move to the far right and start doing things that the far right does. It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable, but it satisfies the immediate urge to do something to stop the wave. And that's what I think you're seeing here. And the legislature itself and the governor, they all know that this is unsustainable, because if the federal legislation passes, if the For the People Act, John Lewis's bill is H.R. 4, but For the People Act, if that passes, all this is moot, Ed. It's over. Because well, there will some be of the federal things that they're legislation. Putting
in the Texas legislation. I know one was the drive-through voting.
Yeah, drive-through
to one place. And right. Houston is the size of New York City. So right, one right. voting booth would never do it for drive-through.
Right, 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 exactly.
What are some of the other things?
Well, they restricted overnight early voting, mail-in voting restrictions put into the law. They also put into the law restrictions on the poll workers. I mean, they made it felonious for the poll workers to even move around and have conversations with voters, because they suspected that, you know, poll workers were trying to help show people how to vote. So they added something to make that.
Isn't that what a poll worker is supposed to do?
Well, there are laws that say, as I understood them here, you know, that you have to maintain a certain distance, and there's certain kind of conversations you're not to have with voters.
Yeah, you can't tell.
The allegation is the opposite. The allegation is that the poll workers were helping voters to vote for the Democrats. That's the allegation. By the way, there is no evidentiary grounds for Senate Bill 1 and House Bill 30, which are the bills, the labels for the bill. There's no evidentiary grounds. Repeat. No evidentiary grounds of this massive voter fraud that they are alleging as the reason to have passed those bills in the first place. There's no data that would validate their assumptions about voter fraud. It doesn't exist, and it doesn't exist in any state where that is being alleged, whether it's Texas or Florida or Arizona. But again, what they specifically were doing was attacking Harris County by restricting the drive-through voting and restricting the number of voting locations in the county, because they then restricted the ability of the county itself to exercise options in the implementation of their election laws. So there's that language that gives the state the ability to say no whenever the county wants to do certain things about its election laws. And that was specifically to attack Harris County, and that was to attack, which is the largest county in the state, and is perhaps the bluest county in the state, where this new majority, which we're talking about, is evident across the board. So it was targeted specifically to slow down the political shift and change that is occurring, but I don't think it's going to be successful because for several reasons, one of which is I think we're going to have a change at some point in the state legislature, but if we pass the federal legislation, that too will I think, reverse the direction.
Wasn't there some solution you couldn't give people water while they were waiting in line? You can't give out water.
I'm sorry, say that again.
You cannot give out water while people are waiting to vote?
Oh, that was Georgia.
Oh, that was Georgia.
Okay. Yeah. That was Georgia. That wasn't Texas. In Texas, they would say, give them some tequila. they could have the tequila, you know. But the major provision, of the bill that was passed was to make it difficult to do early voting and to make it difficult to do drive-through voting and to restrict the number of locations for polling purposes itself. Those were the three specific ways that were designed to discourage people of color from voting by increasing the waiting lines and by making it very difficult and making it, not impossible, because we were successful in organizing our people to, of course, these new laws have not been put in effect yet, but there was this restriction on the number of polling places in Harris County. It didn't work because people were determined that they were going to come out and they were going to vote in this federal election. And there was nothing that was going to stop them because understood.
One of the things I've been saying on my show is you couldn't have a better piece of legislation to get people out to vote. If you tell me I can't vote, I'm going to find a way to vote.
Especially before, if it's been part of your cultural history.
Not indifferent now. And I think Georgia is a primary example. All the suppression they did last time ended up with more people voting than ever.
Yes. They got the opposite effect. Yeah.
Wouldn't have the opposite effect in Texas.
Well, I think we're going to see. Of course, this is intended for the midterms. This piece of legislation that was just passed was intended to facilitate Republican control of the midterms themselves and the success in the midterms. So some of it we don't know, but the battle is not yet over. We've just begun the fight, and I don't think that. First of all, and then the other part of that was making it difficult for registration to take place in addition to the mailing, the actual mail-in voting and early voting. Voter ID laws was another part of what Texas as well as some other states have done to make it very, very difficult to register on the one hand and then to actually vote on election day on the other hand. If you don't have a state-issued ID or some other kind of ID, picture ID, that they've made it very difficult as opposed to making it easier. But AVR, automatic voting registration, is in the For the People Act. And so again, at the federal level.
So when you get your driver's license, you get to vote.
Yeah, or anything, anytime you have any kind of document that is issued, Social Security, voter registration document, driver's license, any and all of that, that would be sufficient and you automatically are registered to vote.
All right.
So that's the other provision.
So you mentioned earlier, there's an election, I guess it's coming up same time as the midterms, and that's the governor's election. Is that the same time?
Yes, that's about the same time.
So mm-hmm. Beto O'Rourke, who's a hero on my show, is possibly running. How's he going to run this campaign? Is he going to run kind of a junior For the People Act to get out the vote? How's he going to run this?
I would imagine that his emphasis is certainly going to be number one on increasing the available voter pool, which is of course the registration side. of the equation. And then secondly, he'll have a very strong ground game to for all the GOTV that will need to be done to ensure to make sure that we can get the vote out despite whatever the constraints and restrictions are, just as we prove we're capable of doing it. And he's a pretty good organizer, by the way. He's a very good motivator, and he's got some good sound administrative skills. I think he understands the process of linking the message of politics with the mechanics of politics. Mm-hmm. That he's very good at that, and he's got the coalition is absolutely and totally with him. We've got a strong movement here called the Moral Monday movement, which is similar to the movement that the brother who comes out of North Carolina, who just did the Poor People's Campaign, and right now I'm having a senior moment, I see his face, but there's a strong Moral Monday movement that has been happening here in Texas that has been fueled by nonprofits, activists, organizers, and faith-based institutions. That is absolutely part of the infrastructure for the ground game, and is very supportive of moving in the direction that Beto is talking about moving. So I think he starts with enormous advantages. He's got the name recognition, he's got the ground game, he's got the message, he's got the ability to raise the funds, and he'll have the entire apparatus of the Democratic Party supporting him. I haven't heard any negative things said about him that would suggest to someone that he is not the candidate who would be preferred to take on this incumbent. And especially people will remember SB1 and HB30. People will remember that this incumbent governor was the one who engineered this very constraining voter suppression legislation in Texas. People will not forget that the very next time that they have the ability to vote, nor will they forget the freeze that we had and the power shortage. Many yes. people put that at the feet of this incumbent governor because he didn't do what should have been done to manage the utility that was responsible for this. He didn't do it. And those were all his friends and his colleagues, and they were all making money. Mm. And that's not going to be forgotten by a lot of people, because that burned a lot of people in the state, not just low and moderate income families, but just middle class people and even people with more resources. It was an equal employer. No, it wasn't equal. I take that back, because the way they did the rollout, the blackouts, they never explained to the public how they decided to blackout, which and what was the sequencing for, because this was calculated. This wasn't just what happened with Ida, where the whole city blanked out because the utility. I wish you would have been there to tell Energy what they should have done right. Ed, I would have loved to have heard that one. But this one was not just random. This was calculated. This was systematic. This was organized and intentional. So people haven't forgotten that. So I think there's a good chance here that with these 18 states that have also passed voter suppression laws, and by the way, there are other states, I think there are 25 or so states that have passed bills making it easier for people to vote. I mean, some of the relevant states in the electoral majority, the Californias and the New York.
Washington, Oregon.
Right. And
Northeastern
Michigan,
states.
Ohio. Right, in the Northeastern states, exactly. And that's another reason for us to have a positive belief that the other side is not going to prevail, that the states that are passing these voter suppression bills right now are the ones that are in red hands. But we don't see that as a permanent state of the politics, because the demographics are changing almost everywhere. Even in the red states, the demographics are changing. So I think we have cause to be optimistic, cautiously optimistic, however, not just optimistic, but cautiously optimistic, that if we play the game right and we organize systematically and scientifically, we will be able to negate this thrust. But we can't be so naive as to think that because we wish it so, it shall be so.
Well, thank you, MT. That's a good way to end it. I think we can't wish it so. Hopefully people will hear this and they'll help make it so. And it's good to see you, and we'll be partners again in that good adventure. I see Martin Luther King right beside you over your left shoulder.
Oh, so yes.
We're still on that trajectory.
Yep. And it's good to see you, and it's good to hear some of the things you're doing. One of these days, that's a place I would like to be. One of my colleagues was Dr. Runoko Rashidi, who was an expert on African descended people in the South Pacific. That was his area of expertise. And I first encountered him way back in the California days. He just recently transitioned. He died on a trip to Egypt. But and I knew Australians in the 1970 Congress of African People. There was a delegation from Australia that came to that event. And that was something that...
Well, the fight's still on here, man.
Yeah, I believe you. Well, one of these days, I'm hoping I'll get a chance to come and see that for myself.
Well, one thing you won't have to do is practice for the fight, because you've been in it and it's the same fight. And you're in great shape. Good to see you, MT.
Good to see you too. And thank you for this opportunity.
And a photo.
We'll do that. Thank you. Okay. Thank you too, Ed. And peace and blessings to you and your family.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Make sure to subscribe to Pacific Conversations wherever you find the podcast. Maybe drop us a review if you're feeling generous. And for weekly US news and current affairs, check out Ed and I's other podcast, US of Ed, also on Facebook and Twitter.